Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at Marines.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi everybody, this is the Cricket Badger podcast.
Each badger marks the track with its own scent.
His black legs are short but very powerful for digging. The name badger probably comes from the French word bêcher, meaning digger.
Hello everybody, welcome along. It's a Cricket Badger podcast with a slight difference today. You've been watching our England against India test match dailies and talking about all things the test matches. We've done the IPL, we're going about to start to the second half of the IPL as well. But every now and again on the Cricket Badger podcast, we break away and we actually talk to people about what they're up to, their love of cricket. And in Tom's case, who I'll introduce in just a second, his career outside of cricket as well. But Tom Holland, historian, TV presenter, radio presenter, author, loads of, there's a long list. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. And great to be here. Very, very grateful to be on.
And charity walker and benefit year this year as well.
It's a one-off, but yes, this year.
Well, let's talk about that because it's the author's cricket team, isn't it, that you play for and you've been right. Awarded the benefit for. And this is quite a long-standing cricket team, isn't it, who basically a set of writers that get together and play cricket.
Well, it goes all the way back to Arthur Conan Doyle, P.G. Woodhouse, Jerome K. Jerome, J.M. Barrie. So really, you know, really major names.
They're big paths to fill, aren't they, or whatever?
Really, well, Conan Doyle famously got W.G. Grace out. It'd be a terrible poem about it. I don't have it to hand, which is probably just as well, because anyone who likes poetry would flinch, I think, and go pale at the sound of it.
Did W.G. Grace walk, or did he say this, the public have come to see me like he tended to?
He'd already scored 100.
Ah, well, yeah. I've never had that luxury in my own cricket career to be able to... Yeah.
So the heyday was before the First World War, and then obviously the First World War put a bit of a dampener on things. And it's been... The authors have been refounded sporadically ever since. Recent incarnation, they were founded in 2011. So we've all been playing for about 10 for a decade, which of course is after a decade, you're eligible for a benefit. So that's what I've been awarded. Very exciting. And basically, of course, you know, normally benefit for county player, you have matches and it goes to the county player. In my case, the money is going towards three homelessness charities.
I really like that as well, Tom, because before I got into working in cricket, about 2005, 2006, I was actually a housing officer for a local authority, changed career completely, worked with homeless people. And I think it's talk us through the three causes. And while you're doing that, I'll flash up the links that people give to your benefit.
So the first one is The Passage, which is a very established homelessness charity, works across the board. The second one is it's a project under the umbrella of St Martin in the Fields, which is the church just off Trafalgar Square in the middle of London that has a kind of incredible track record of helping the homeless. And what this project is, it helps specifically for women who are long-term homeless, to give them a space that is women-only, so that they can have kind of long-term shelter and not kind of worry about the things that come from, you know, not being in a women-only centre. And the third one is a slight change of emphasis. And it's a charity that's helping the Yazidis, who are a religious minority in Iraq that were horribly targeted for persecution by the Islamic State in 2014, when the Islamic State invaded and conquered a large stretch of northern Iraq. And they massacred the men they captured, often crucified them. And they, they literally enslaved women and girls as young as eight, took them off into slavery, sex slavery, every kind of slavery you could imagine. And although the Islamic State had been defeated, there's still a lot of the scars of this are terrible, and their homes have been absolutely destroyed. So they're still in refugee camps. And I made a film about them about 5 years ago. And so they live in my memory like that. And when I was out in Iraq, it was kind of very hot. And I visited their main settlement, where the Islamic State were a couple of miles away across open ground. And we went to visit a place where a whole group of women had been shot. So their bones were littered everywhere. And I kind of, the thought of playing cricket came into my mind as something to cling on to amid all the horror and the bleakness of this. And so when I came back, the converse of that was that I would try and keep them in my mind when I was playing cricket. So that's very much been the inspiration for this, is keeping in mind people who, you know, I just feel so lucky playing cricket, and particularly for the authors. We play such wonderful, wonderful places, that it's just a way of hopefully trying to get some money off the back of that we can help with people who are much less fortunate.
Anybody watching the podcast, there's the link, and I'll stick it on the link for the people that listen to this later on the audio. You laughed when I said the traditional audio platform, because podcasts haven't been around for long. So traditional is all relative, I guess, isn't it? This is one of the problems with kind of making a reference like that to a historian, I guess, because your sort of length of time stretches a lot further back.
Well, I do a podcast as well called The Rest is History. And we did one last week where we interviewed Mark Andreessen, who is an absolute kind of tech titan. He basically invented the web browser. He's on the board of Facebook, all kinds of things like that. And he was talking to us about the history of Silicon Valley, which I think is really interesting. I mean, it's recent history, but it's seismic history. And by the end, you know, the discussion of history had become a discussion of the future. And this is absolutely, you know, what historians look at.
I've had that conversation a lot with people about how things, just in my lifetime, have moved on. When I was a kid, there were three channels on the television. I think we were about the same age, actually, but there were about three channels on the same television. We got Channel 4. That was a major event. Now there are hundreds of TV channels. We can do this, and we can talk to each other and broadcast live via our laptops and what have you. Things are just crazy. I mean, what's it going to be like in 30, 40 years' time? It's scary almost.
I imagine we'll have kind of chips embedded in our hair, and we'll just be able to kind of blink, see everything scroll in front of us. Yeah. But I was kind of thinking that about the lack of television coverage this summer, because one of the things I felt this summer about cricket and the international cricket and the domestic cricket was I had absolutely no sense at all of the structure of it. It had completely blurred. I didn't know when the tests were, you know, what the 100 were. I mean, it was all just a complete mess. And I remembered how structured the season was when I first got into cricket in 81 and through the 80s, that you knew that, you know, when the one-day matches would be, when the tests would be, when the county finals would be, what the championship structure was. And it seemed to kind of reflect the fact that there was really a BBC. And even though it was really annoying and it would, you know, endlessly be going off to racing or whatever, it did kind of anchor you. You kind of knew where to look. Whereas now I feel like, you know, a kind of a boy in a sweetie shop, and I just don't know where to begin. There's just almost too much. Choice is too great.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. And I think, I mean, the premise of the 100, which I'm not a big fan of, but the premise of the 100 in terms of attracting a new audience, I think what you've just said there, the foundation of attracting a new audience is give them a landscape that can actually get their heads around. And at the moment, it is all a bit scattergun. And the ECB admitted, I think, this summer that the fixtures needed to be a little bit more coordinated.
Cricket's a game played with balls. You've got to look after them in the field. Badgers are furry creatures. My friends at manscaped.com help you make sure it's neat and tidy down there. Oh, get rid of all that excess fur. Make sure that you're neat and tidy. Make sure everything's in the right order. Oh, I'm feeling all good now down in my set. Oh, manscaped.com. Maximum skin safe performance, compact design, advanced engineering, ceramic blade, waterproof. And it doesn't end there. Show you care by caring for your pair. Cleansers, revivers, preservers. Simply go to manscaped.com. Quote the discount code Badger. You get 20% off, you get free shipping, and you get some seriously quality equipment. Manscaped.com. Get on there now.
Let's get on to your cricket walk that you did. You did it on Monday the 23rd of August, if you kept to your schedule on that one. And you basically, you walked, was it 55 miles? Was that
55 miles in 24 hours.
Yeah, and you basically took in some notable landmarks that were kind of cricket-related as you went along that walk.
Yeah, so it was a cricket-themed. It was a walk through cricket's history. And so we began at Bramley, which is a village outside Guildford.
I imagine that you sat down and thought, what am I going to do for this benefit year? How am I going to raise some money?
Yeah.
And the cricket walk through cricket's history, that kind of combines the two things nicely,
well,
doesn't it?
Well, we've done various things. So we've done kind of evening events on Zoom when we were still under lockdown, and quizzes and all kinds of things like that. And we've done auctions. But we also did a walk earlier, so I think in April, where we walked from a cricket ground at one end of the M25 to the other end. So we began, I can't remember, it's a cricket ground directly above the M25. It's kind of amazing. Tunnel goes underneath it. And then up to the other end to Chertsey, which is where the middle stump was first used. We went via Lords, Craven Cottage and Twickenham. So there was a kind of sports theme there. But then this time we focused just on the cricket, and we discovered that you know, we made lots of, we raised a lot more sponsorship doing the walks than almost anything else. So that's why we wanted to do a second one. And we'd always thought it would be brilliant to do one that where we looked at, you know, we visited some of the sites of grounds that had played key role in the history of cricket, taverns where various lords had met up to draw up rules, all that kind of stuff. Famous people had lived, that kind of thing. And we kind of looked at a map, put the dots, and then joined the dots up. Because the previous one was 45 miles in a day. And so we thought, we'll go that little further. We'll do 55 miles in 24 hours. So we went from Bramley, which was where the first recorded women's cricket match took place. And we walked to Lords. But we went, once we'd reached London, we started zigzagging all over the place.
The first recorded women's match took place in, was it 1597?
1745.
Okay.
Reported the Reading Mercury, the greatest that was played in this part of England between 11 maids of Bramley and 11 maids of Hambledon, all dressed in white. The Bramley maids had blue ribbons and the Hambledon maids red ribbons on their heads. The girls bowled, batted, ran and catched as well as most men could do. So there was a tone of sexist sport reporting that you probably wouldn't be allowed.
No. I was just thinking that as you were reading that you wouldn't get Nasser Hussain and Shane Warne introducing TV coverage in the same manner these days, would you?
No, I doubt they'd be wearing pink ribbons.
That, I imagine, as a historian, that kind of tickles your fancy in two ways there. You kind of, the love of cricket and the love of history combined as you meander around for 55 miles.
Absolutely. Well, the fact that cricket is old, I have to admit, is a real part of the appeal to me. And I also like the way that cricket endlessly reinvents itself. So I actually liked the 100. Because one of the things you realise when you look at the history of cricket and you think about how it's evolved over all these centuries is that it is a sport that, despite its reputation for kind of stuffiness and conservatism, is unbelievably innovative. And I think that one of the measures of that is precisely that today you have all these different formats. I can't think of a comparable sport, really, where players play to the highest possible level in three completely different formats that require very different kind of attributes.
Tom, these days, is white ball against red ball. It's almost like two separate sports under the same banner, really, isn't it?
Yes, and I think, you know, even 50 over in 2020, the talents and the approach required is very different. And you said you didn't like the 100. I mean, I watched several matches and I was just stupefied by the level of skill. And then to see that kind of transferred back into the Test arena, I thought, I think this is absolutely, you know, I started with a whinge, but I actually think this is incredible age for cricket.
I'll tell you very quickly why I don't like it. It's not because of the cricket. It's not because of the actual experience of watching the 100. I just think it has a knock-on effect to the rest of the domestic
cricket. I understand that.
Yeah,
it's bad for the counties and it's bad for the structure of the season. But I'll tell you the reason, my big gripe against it, you talked about history, there seemed to me an obvious way, because part of the appeal of county cricket is, of course, that it's rooted in history. Mm. So you've got that sense of, you know, deeply rooted in these grounds, the statistics, all that, all those traditions. So I thought that one way around the whole problem of the fact that franchises don't have that would be to base it on the ancient Anglo-Saxon kingdom. So this was very much my pitch, that rather than having whatever it is, the Southern Braves or whatever, it should be Wessex, and you should have the ancient battle flag of the Saxon kings, and you should have Mercia, and you should have the Danelaw, and you should have Northumbria and all that kind of stuff. And I just thought that was much better. So the way that I got into it was that we went to see the Southern Braves against, was it London Spirit, the ersatz Middlesex one at Lord's. So I thought of it as the West Saxons against the men of London and women of Londonwick, and that really enhanced it for me. So I think that they missed a trick by not doing that. I think it would definitely have got the Anglo-Saxon fans.
The names were peculiar and often controversial, I think, and changed a few times before they settled on the final versions.
You are listening to the Cricket Badger podcast.
Going back into your career then, as a historian, I mean, obviously at school, I imagine history was a subject that enthralled you to some degree. But how did your career as a historian then develop? I mean, it's not necessarily something that, you know, when kids are at school talking about being train drivers or whatever.
Because I read, you know, various books and I thought, oh, I'd love to write that. And essentially, that's what I've managed to do. So it's kind of a dream come true.
When we press record, Tom, I was commenting on your bookcase behind you, and then you just tilted your
laptop. Yes, did you want to do that?
So I want to see the full height of it, so the viewers can actually see just how many books are in your... I mean, you have to scale that to actually... Hopefully the ones right at the top. You said the ones right at the top are the cricket books, didn't you?
Yeah, they are. They're the cricket books that I probably won't be reading soon.
Yeah, you almost need to make as much effort to get those top shelf books as you would to walk 55 miles.
I've got another section of treasured cricket books which I can sell. So it's all very carefully sorted and arranged. Yeah, well, I mean, you can't write history without loads of books. And that was particularly the case in the library. So actually, the number of books has swelled considerably.
So, I mean, where do you go then? When you finish doing your university, you got your degree, you want to make a career in that. How does that follow? How do you get into history as a job?
Well, I wanted to be a great novelist. So I began as a novelist, and I wrote a novel in which Lord Byron was a vampire. So Byron was the model for the first vampire story, and in my version, he really was a vampire. And it kind of did sufficiently well that I got a deal with both American and British publishers to do three more. It didn't change the world, but it gave me just enough to kind of keep going. And they were all set in various different periods of history. And I just realized that I enjoyed writing about the history much more than I did in kind of making stuff up about vampires. Vampires had never really been part of my career plan. So I finished that. I worked that contract out. And then I thought, well, you know, I'll write a book about actual history. And I did it on the two periods of history that I'd most loved, which was the age of Julius Caesar. So that was the first I wrote. And then the Persian invasion of Greece, which is Marathon, Thermopylae, Salamis, you know, 300 Spartans in Speedos, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, that's essentially how I began. I kind of, it took me time to work out what it was that I wanted to do. So it's like, I guess, like kind of, you know, you focus on red ball cricket and then you discover actually you're a white ball cricketer or something like that. It took me time to work out where I should probably be focusing my attention.
I was going to ask you a question that would have led you into that really, but if you were on Mastermind, what would be your specialist subject? And as a historian, do you have to have a specialist subject, or can you be all years, all men kind of thing?
Well, on Mastermind, I don't know what my subject on Mastermind would be. It probably wouldn't be history, because you'd want to kind of snip things strategically, wouldn't you? I see, was it somebody was on doing the career of Gower, of David Gower, recently. Okay. And I thought, actually, that's quite a good one, because that one you can really kind of prepare. I guess if it was a historical period, it would be the Persian Wars. But there's, you know, there's a lot of scope there to get things wrong. You know, it's like, you know, the more you know about cricket, the more you study it, the more you're, you know, if you know everything about world cricket, you're better qualified to write about English cricket, right? I mean, that's, you know, or, you know, if you know about English cricket, you're better equipped to write about Indian cricket, whatever. I find the more different periods of history I study, the more I can write about it.
And you've done TV documentaries as well. Islam and ISIS, I mean, there's two there that you've done for television, which obviously relate around the Muslim faith and the history of that area of the world. And I was actually watching one just before we started here. I was watching the first 10 minutes of one of your documentaries, and I'll watch the rest of it when we finish. Is that a kind of a specialist subject? Is that something you enjoy or something that really interests you? Presumably it does.
See, in a sense, the fields of history that I have explored have been conditioned by the previous works and areas. So my great interest was always the classical world, so Greece and Rome. But the more I wrote about them, the more I'd always had this kind of vague sense that they were basically like us. But the more I wrote about them, the more I felt these are big people are unfathomably strange and different and alien. And it's not just a question of kind of translating things that we understand and putting it back in, you know, their exact equivalents. They occupy a completely different mindset. They're spectacularly odd. And the more I thought about, well, what is it that changed, the more I came to the conclusion that it's basically the emergence of Christianity and Islam. I wrote about Islam, and then I've just written a book about Christianity. And I think that they are just massively, massively transformative in ways that we have now forgotten, because we, in a sense, have been changed so deeply by them that we don't even appreciate it. And it's the revolutions that kind of succeed that tend to be forgotten. It's the ones that fail that kind of, you know, that we remember. You know, whether it's in the Muslim world, the Islamic revolution, or in our world, the Christian revolution, so profound that essentially that's what has become my great focus. What was it about Christianity, for instance, that means that the ancient world, the classical world that preceded it, is now so utterly different to us?
I used to think I did history to A level, and I used to think when I was being taught it, if I was going to be a teacher, probably history would be my subject, because once you've kind of got your head around it, you're saying the same things year on year. As a historian, though, I imagine that's not the case. It's not like set in stone. You are looking back in history. You are finding out new things. You are developing kind of themes there.
Yeah, I think that what tends to be most interesting about the past is the way that it's very different and the effort that's required to appreciate just how different it is. And I think also that, so one of the things that interests me about cricket is that we don't actually know where it comes from. And it's that then becomes kind of part of the appeal. And I think that I've always been very interested in the question of origins and where things begin and how far back can we trace stuff. And it's where the origin point starts to become blurred or mythical or fabricated or whatever, that I find really interesting, because that's kind of where you can you see the process by which civilization is made, in a sense. And it could be, you know, a sport like cricket, or it could be, you know, the history of a city like Rome, or it could be the history of a great faith like Islam, that there's a point where the stories that are told of its beginnings are obviously mythical, and the character of those myths are always fascinating to look at.
If I was to tell you, you could have three people from history around for dinner, and
yes,
you want to have a nice conversation and pick their brains about maybe some of the stuff that you've studied in the past, who would you have around your dinner table?
Okay, that's a great question. I would have Herodotus, who is the first historian who writes the history of the Persian Wars, my favourite subject, and whose history I've translated, and who's just kind of infinitely fascinated about everything. I mean, he's interested in everything. And so his book is just fascinating, and he's a kind of endlessly curious, endlessly charming guy who I suspect would be great. I'd be quite... who else would I want? I would want... I'd be quite interested in meeting Lady Castlemaine, Barbara Villiers, who was Charles II's mistress, was kind of famously horrible, but famously charismatic, incredibly entertaining. She'd bitch for England. And I think that would be great fun. And I think I'd have Lord Byron, not least because I could talk to him about cricket, because he was a very keen cricketer and actually played at Lord's below somebody called Shakespeare.
Wow. All right, you've got one place setting left, and you're allowed to have one cricketer to come along and join you. He can sit next to Byron, and you can basically talk about cricket with this person, live or dead.
I think Sangakkara.
Oh, wow, okay. He's
an incredibly interesting guy who's very charming, clearly very charming, but just very smart, and has obviously thought about cricket an enormous amount. Whenever I hear him talk about cricket, I always think, you're a very interesting man. I'd like to hear more.
Stories I've heard about Kim Sangakkara is he's actually a real gentleman as well, a really nice bloke, well as a very intelligent bloke, as well as a very fine cricketer.
So I think he'd be able to handle Byron, who'd be a massive egotist. I think he'd be able to handle Lady Castlemaine, who I think would be trouble. And I'm sure he'd get on well with the Herodotus, who would be very interested to talk to him, explain cricket to him. So I think that would be a really good dinner party.
Herodotus, the writer that you admire and have translated, then are you the modern day version?
No, I wouldn't presume. I mean, I don't think anyone is remotely qualified to be the new Herodotus. But because basically the new Herodotus is, well, I mean, basically it's Wikipedia. The thing about Herodotus, he's the first person really to write nonfiction. So he's the origin point for what I do. Because he's described as a historian. He does tell the story of the Persian invasion, but that's to do him down. I mean, he's interested in everything. He's interested in, why Egyptian men pee sitting down and Egyptian women pee standing up. He's interested in why Scythians get stoned out on bongs. He's interested in animals. He's interested in rivers. He's interested in absolutely everything. And it's that sense of kind of voracious curiosity that I think would make him just infinitely fascinating.
Well, you just said that interests me, actually, because I think for most people, you think of history as a set of dates, or who was king at the time, or who was prime minister at a certain time, or whatever. There's kind of like signposts in your brain. But some of the stuff that you just mentioned there, at peeing, standing up and stuff, it's how things were in those worlds as well, isn't it? It's adding the colour to those dates, isn't it?
Well, the thing is also with Herodotus, you're never entirely sure whether what he's saying is true. So he's known as the father of history, but he's also been known as the father of lies. And he does come out. Is that a marmot behind you?
It is. It's quite a famous photograph that I had. Philip Brown, the cricket photographer, on the podcast recently, and he was looking at that and he said, "Oh, James, that's the award winning photograph from about 2 or 3 years ago, isn't it?" And I've had it blown up on the canvas. And I always looked at it as two very cute looking animals that were running, sort of like frolicking along. And he said, you do realise that in about 3 seconds' time, the one on the left is going to eat the one on the right, don't you?
Well, so the reason I asked about that is that Herodotus tells this story about how in India there's loads of gold. And the way that the Indians get the gold is that they go out into the desert. And in the desert, there are giant ants that burrow down. And as they burrow down, they kick up the gold. And the Indians sneak up and grab the gold and then run away. And the ants chase them. And they have to kind of, they cut off, various animals to throw to the giant ants, who then eat the thing. And people always cited this as an obvious example of the fact that Herodotus is mad and or making it up or stoned or whatever. Where's he getting this from? There is a brilliant theory that actually the Greek word that he's using for ant, there's obviously been a process of Chinese whispers, and that perhaps the original word was a Bactrian word or whatever for marmots that dig underground, scoop it up and dig up gold. And this is the theory. And it may be true or it may be not. But actually, the thing is that people who sneer at Herodotus for getting this wrong, what's amazing is that he knows anything at all about India, that he's even heard of it. Because it's the far end of the world. That's what's amazing about him. He may get things wrong, but what's remarkable and creditable is that he's knows enough about stuff to get them wrong. That's the incredible thing.
That he was trying in the first place to find out.
Trying in the first place. Yes, absolutely.
Going back to cricket then, the authors and your place in that side, what are you? Are you a bowler batsman? Or
I'm a... So I'm a bowler, and I'd always run my own team, which was kind of faintly shambolic. And we kind of played in a variety of grounds around the M25. They weren't particularly scenic. And I'd just turned 40 and I was kind of thinking, is it time to retire? Have I probably done enough? And then the authors got revived and it came with a book deal. So it was founded by Charlie Campbell. He's an author, revived by Charlie. And he sold it to Bloomsbury, who the publishers of J.K. Rowling. So they were absolutely flush with Harry Potter cash. So we got a bit of the Harry Potter cash. And we were able to, the device for the book, that it would be a journal of the year, cricket year, and that each author would write about a particular theme focused on a particular ground. So, for instance, we had one about cricket and history, and we played at Hambledon. We had one about cricket and beauty, and we played in the Valley of the Rocks. So it was that kind of thing. And the one that I did was... we played at Eton against the Eton Thirds, and it was about age and youth. And the very first game we played in Victoria Park, and it was kind of grim, and I hadn't realised it was an all-weather pitch, and I turned up without proper footwear and skidded everywhere, and it was wet and awful, and I just thought, that's terrible, I'm not going to play. But I had to do this second one. And also, I wanted to see Eton. I'd never been to Eton. So we went there, and again, it was 2012, and it was that kind of awful, grey, wet summer. I don't even remember, before the Olympics, it kind of rained almost nonstop. And we got there and there was this kind of low drizzle and we fielded and I opened the bowling and I kind of felt, I bowled so badly in the first match that every time I even got it faintly on the pitch, people would kind of applaud me like they, they might applaud a kind of baby not sticking his finger in the socket or something. I mean, it was embarrassing. And they got, I don't know, 200 or something. I didn't really star with the ball or anything. And I came off and I thought, this is miserable. I'm hopeless. It's all over. I don't want to start playing for this. And then we batted. I was in at 11. We were obviously going to lose. I went in and we still needed 80 to win. And this bowler kind of speared it in and I had a massive great smack and somehow it went for six. I'd never hit a six before.
Oh, this is good. This is what I've been looking at your Wikipedia page and yeah. It's the most famous six of all time or something it's referred to.
Because it was photographed. Because this was a book, we had Nayu, who was professional photographer, who followed us around and took photographs. And he took three photographs of me hitting this six. And I just got onto Twitter. I didn't really understand it. And I suddenly thought, I could just put this out as often as I like. So I would say that since then, there's barely a week where I haven't put out this photograph of me hitting a six. And it was so exciting. And I felt so invigorated that it completely restored my enthusiasm for cricket. And so I've played for a decade since. But I would say, I've never hit a six since. I've never really, my batting has never really fired. But I have kind of spasms where I bowl fine and then spasms where I bowl terribly. And it kind of comes and goes. I had a very good start to the season. I got lots of wickets. And then I think I've got one wicket in the past couple of months. It's kind of been a terrible sequence. And the most recent match was against the Lords Taverners. Had Matthew Hoggard and all kinds of people. And we'd beaten them, I think, three times in a row. So this time they were determined to win. And they needed 24 off the last over, which I bowled. And they got it.
Oh, no.
That's my last over of the summer. So it's going to haunt me all winter. So I'm currently in a shall I retire state of mind at the moment.
That can't be the full stop.
I hope not.
That's a nice draw in, though, Tom. You're going to basically be looking forlornly out the window thinking of that over, aren't you?
I wake up in the middle of the night and think, oh, it's just a nightmare. Oh, no, it wasn't. It really happened.
Who was responsible?
I was some 22-year-old bastard. he was kind of lean and young. And I think there was one guy who'd played for Kenya. And I think this guy was minor county. So it's incredibly unfair. I mean, because not only am I 53, but I was never very good in the first place. I cling to that. But, these things.
That can't be your last act as a cricketer. It can't be. I'm just looking at your charitable page. Looking at how much you've earned so far, it's going all right, isn't it?
Yeah, I think north of 60 grand, isn't it? Last time.
You've got, at the moment, it's currently on 60,260 with the target of being 100,000. So listeners, viewers, you can actually help push that up a little bit closer. If anybody got 40 grand out there, then
very gratefully received.
Even if it's a fiver, anything, because they are three very, very good causes. Homeless charities of various natures that Tom's supporting with that. And if we can help on the Cricket Badger podcast to push that up a little bit further, then that's fantastic.
I'd like to say that the cricket world generally has been brilliant at this. So, you've got me on podcast. We've got these various videos, which is kind of like at the top of my Twitter feed. But there were several where we've got Alistair Cook, Jimmy Anderson, Hoggard, Caddick, various people, all kind of sending best wishes, Ian Bell, Mark Butcher. Fantastic. People rallying around kind of to an amazing degree. And everybody in the office has just been brilliant. I mean, it's because although I'm the ostensibly the guy who's got the benefit, really it's a kind of group effort for the authors. We're all doing it, and it's something I think that has given structure to the year aside from the cricket.
What's next for you then in terms of your historical bent? Are you got any more TV work planned, anything else planned for getting your teeth into?
No I did this last TV one where we went to northern Iraq and walked around among the bones, and I thought, I've I don't really want to do this anymore. So I am currently, I've done three books. I've done two books on the Romans. I've done one on the age of Julius Caesar. Then I did one on the age of the first emperors, which is Caligula and Nero and all that crew. And now I'm doing one on the kind of heyday of the Roman Empire, which is Pompeii, the Colosseum, all that kind of stuff, Hadrian. So that's what I'm doing at the moment.
I can't believe, I mean, just tilt your camera back up again. All of those books behind you, and you tell me that you read basically every word that's behind you there. That's a very impressive.
Every word maybe is an exaggeration, but certainly they've all been used. They've all been used.
That's a pretty impressive library there. And it's been a real pleasure to meet you today, Tom. I wish you every success with taking that total up to as close to that target and beyond it as possible of 100,000. If you can give at all, it's givergy.uk/Tom Holland. And I'll stick that on the podcast text as well so that people can follow that link to try and support you as well. Is the walk the last of your initiatives this year? Have you got anything else to do?
I haven't decided. We're working on that. So we're doing it with Matt Thacker, who I know you know, who kind of fixed all this and stuff. So I think that there'll be more to come, but we're working on it, because obviously 40 to go. It's kind of like we're running out of time. You know, the overs are ticking away, the Duckworth Lewis.
Never too late to hit 24 off the final over.
Exactly. That's probably the lesson I should be drawing. Yes, yeah, so we think of some equivalent of 24 off the final over, but we're working on it.
Tom, been a pleasure. Wish you all the best for your future endeavours, and thank you very much indeed for joining me on today's Cricket Badger podcast.
Thanks ever so much for having me. Thanks a lot.
Sports Social Podcast Network.